This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
You know our weather has gone weird as the climate begins to shift. Science has predicted what will happen, depending on how many more megatons of greenhouse gases we toss into the sky. But it's not that simple. We have three guests here to explain. Earth's system has countless interactions between living things and the physical cycles and forces found on this planet. For example, there are feedbacks, changes in oceans, a melting ice cover, and thawing permafrost, all interworking with forests and the different species on Earth. Scientists are working on all that as fast as they can. But there's one more big variable left out. What will humans do? And are there human feedbacks? To find out, New Science combines basic psychology with climate models. On January 1st, the paper, Linking Models of Human Behavior and Climate, Alters Projected Climate Change, that was published in the journal Nature Climate Change. I haven't explained it very well yet, but it's a big deal. It turns out our behavior could determine whether we can keep living on this planet and what it would be like. To get into this new approach and why it matters, I've interviewed two co-authors of that paper. Dr. Brian Bekich is the lead author. He's a statistics and modeling expert from the Department of Plant Biology at the University of Vermont in Burlington. For the climate psychology, we will talk with co-author Dr. Catherine Lacasse from the Department of Psychology at Rhode Island College. So I'm going to weave back and forth between the two, starting with Brian Bekich from Vermont.
Radio EcoShock.
Brian, when we try to see into our climate future, how much do human choices now matter?
Human choices matter a lot. Humans are increasingly exerting a very strong influence on the climate system as well as other Earth systems. And so what we do now and in the future is likely to have a very large impact on the future state of the climate.
And that's partly what your paper is about, is trying to judge what the range of those impacts might be, depending on what we do.
Exactly. So what we did in this paper was we tried to incorporate a model of how humans behave, and specifically how people perceive risk from climate change, associated with climate change, and how that might alter their behaviors, specifically with respect to emissions. And so that feeds back into the climate system. So yes, we wanted to integrate the human component, in so much the human behavioral component, into these models of the climate system.
I notice in your recent study you used a baseline of 4.9 degrees C global warming over pre-industrial by the year 2100. From the scientists I talk with, that's a disaster that could end civilization as we know it. Why such a high baseline?
The reason we used that baseline was because in the version of the SeaRoads climate model we used for our study, that was the baseline in that model. And it comes from, I believe, the A1FI scenario under the older pathways that the United Nations had, IPCC had. And I expect, although I don't know for certain, but I expect that the reason they used that scenario was because that seemed to be at the time, at least, the most likely pathway that emissions were taking.
And what is the lowest warming your study suggests we could achieve if humans react properly, and then the highest, depending on what we do?
So within the bounds of our model, and there's a lot of assumptions that go into that model, a lot of simplifications, the low was 3.4 degrees Celsius, and the high was 6.2 degrees Celsius. But I want to emphasize that our model was not intended to be predictive, but was more intended to show the importance of integrating human perception of risk and human behavioral responses to climate into the model, into models of the climate system, in order to show that they can have a very significant effect on our future climate trajectory. And so that was the purpose of our linking this model of human behavior with a climate model, was to demonstrate how important and significant this coupling could be.
When governments meet to set target emissions to save our climate, or when the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change issues reports, do they factor in human responses to climate change?
Okay, so that's a little bit of a complex question, and let me say that they do to some degree, and so particularly with adaptation responses. So as climate changes, sea levels rise, and you have different patterns of precipitation and temperature, and so that can pose a challenge to humans and human society. And so there are adaptation responses associated with that, and so these IPCC reports do consider those adaptation responses. In this paper, in our study, what we wanted to do was look at more the mitigation component of climate change, which is trying to reduce the magnitude of future climate change. In that respect, I don't think there is very much done with human behavioral responses. So at least in that dynamic context where the climate system and the human responses interact with each other. So what's typically done, as far as my understanding goes, is they develop these static pathways of future climate change depending on how humans and our governments respond to climate change. And those are static, and then they run out the models to see what the impact is on the climate system. And in this paper and in this study, what we did was we linked those two, human responses to emissions behavior, so that there's a dynamic linkage between them, and so that what humans do affects the climate system, and then what the climate does affects human responses.
Okay, I'd like to get to the psychology angle of this, and you're using the theory of planned behavior. First of all, can you make a working model out of that theory? And also, with your computing expertise, how comfortable and confident are you in Isaac Asgen's work being applied to climate forecasts?
To be honest with you, I think those are probably better questions for Katie, who will be on in a little while, but I'll go ahead and attempt to address them anyway. So, you know, the theory of planned behavior is a model or conceptual framework that has been used quite extensively, and as we use it in our current coupled model, a climate and human behavior model, it's a fairly simplistic representation of how humans respond. And so the reason we did this initially was because you wanted to see what the range of potential impacts of coupling these two models are. And so typically, from a modeling or a scientific perspective, you often start off with a simple representation of the system to see how important the processes you're looking at can be. And so it's kind of an exploratory phase where you want to see, is it worth going in greater detail and more precision to link human responses and human behavior to a climate model? I will admit that this is a relatively simple model of human behavior, but the impacts are so large that I think it merits increased study and incorporation of models of increasing complexity that are more realistic, account more realistically for human behavior and risk perception and how that impacts emissions.
Your study, Catherine, makes use of a psychological system called the theory of planned behavior. Who originated that, and what is it?
So, yes, that theory was originated by a psychology researcher named Ichek Azen. And basically, the purpose of the theory was to try to explain how people make a decision about whether or not they want to perform a behavior. And so the theory was very simple. It just looked at people's attitudes about the behavior, so how positively or negatively they felt about it, what people perceived the social norms around the behavior to be, and how much control they felt they had over whether or not they could perform the behavior. And by looking at those three elements, you could predict whether or not someone was going to actually take an action. I'd say they kept it really general on purpose so that it could be applied to a wide range of behaviors. And this theory has been used in a variety of different scenarios. So it's been used by health researchers to try to determine whether or not people are going to follow their doctor's advice or do actions that are healthy for them. And it's also been used by a lot of environmental psychologists to try to predict whether people will take actions that will be environmentally friendly.
Two key concepts keep coming up in this paper. And the first is, and you mentioned this, perceived behavioral control. Can you please explain that?
Yeah, and so that certainly is an important part of the theory. And basically, all that means is how much control you think you have over whether or not you can perform the behavior. Another way to think of it is just how easy is the behavior for you to perform? And there might be a variety of reasons that the behavior is more easy or more difficult. It could be, how expensive is the behavior? Can you afford it? It could be, do you feel like you have the skills or knowledge to actually do the behavior, or do you not really know where to start? And it also could just be if the behavior is available to you or not. One example I like to use because it's from my own life, you might think recycling is a great idea, but if you live in an apartment complex that doesn't offer any way to recycle, it is going to be a lot harder for you to go out and make sure that you can recycle if you don't have it easily accessible.
And the other key concept is perceived social norms. What are those?
Basically, what that's referring to is how common or how socially acceptable you perceive a behavior to be. And so on the one hand, it's a lot easier to go ahead and do a behavior that's really common, that many other people are doing. No one's going to hassle you for it. No one's going to question why you're doing it. And so there are social reasons why it might make a behavior easier. But the other part of that is that if a lot of people around you are doing a particular behavior, that gives you a sense of how important that behavior is to your community, for example. So if everyone around you is recycling, that kind of gives you a signal that, you know, this is something people value, and it will make it more likely that you'll also go ahead and do the behavior.
Given all that, in general terms, what are the factors which takes a person from climate inaction to making real changes to reduce emissions?
To start off with, I would say there's quite a bit of research done by environmental psychologists looking at just this. You know, when will people respond to climate change and actively start reducing their emissions? In our model, we wanted to focus on specifically how people might respond to experiencing climate change, which we know is somewhat important. So we looked at, will people notice as there's more extreme events that arise due to climate change? And experiencing more extreme events may lead them to view climate change as a greater risk, and this might make it more likely that they want to start reducing their emissions. In our model, we looked at this risk perception along with perceived behavioral control, how easy people thought it was to reduce their emissions, and perceived social norms, so how common they viewed reducing your emissions to be. And what we found really was that perceived behavioral control and perceived social norms in combination seem to be very, very important. So when we ran all the different simulations on our model and we looked at the simulations that led to the greatest amount of emissions reductions and the smallest increase in global temperature, those simulations were ones in which perceived behavioral control was very, very high, so people thought it was easy to reduce their emissions, and also were scenarios where perceived social norms was very, very high. So they perceived that it was common. So those two things in combination seem to matter a lot.
And how much does it matter, Catherine, if humans think we can change the climate outcome or if we perceive climate change as something entirely beyond our personal control?
So we did look at this. We did include this in our model to see how much it mattered. We called this perceived efficacy in our model. So the idea, you know, does my behavior have any impact on the environment? Or, as you said, is it kind of beyond my control? And what we found is that in our model, varying this didn't seem to have too much of an impact. When we looked at scenarios where perceived efficacy was really high or scenarios where perceived efficacy was really low, we didn't see too many differences in emissions changes or in global temperature predictions.
That's really interesting. Does the theory of planned behavior contemplate highly irrational responses like a diversionary war, a distracting plague, or widespread public apathy and greed as now?
Well, I would say the theory of planned behavior doesn't really focus on those things. It would be a bit beyond that particular theory. The focus of the theory of planned behavior is, again, really looking at how individuals make a decision about whether they want to perform a behavior or not. And so in our model, we really looked at it that way, focused on explaining individual actions, and then kind of multiplied it across the population. But I would say there certainly are social theories that look at how groups or governments might respond to some of those things you mentioned, to extreme events or to lack of resources and things like that. And you could take one of those theories and couple it with a climate model in a very similar way that we took the theory of planned behavior and coupled it to a climate model. And you could run that coupled climate model to actually test and see if those kinds of group or government responses lead to large changes in emissions and have an impact on predicted global temperature.
I'm looking forward to that study.
Yes. I think those are some next steps.
Now, what makes psychologists think that experiencing an extreme weather event like a fire leads to changes in people's behavior when it comes to emissions?
To start off, I would say that there is some mixed evidence. When you look at the research that's been done surveying or interviewing people after they've experienced an extreme event. So some people find that after an extreme event, people are more concerned about climate change and they do want to take action, whereas research done on other extreme events, you know, finds that people don't really get more concerned, that there's not too much of an impact. I'd say across all those studies, what we think seems to be the most important is how an individual interprets the event that they're experiencing and if they link it to climate change at all. One thing that matters a lot is people's pre-existing beliefs. So you can imagine that someone who's already very concerned about climate change, if they experience a hurricane or a flood or some other kind of extreme event that is a known outcome of climate change, that they would very quickly say, aha, this is due to climate change, and it would even strengthen their concern. Whereas someone who is not very concerned about climate change or, you know, hasn't really spent a lot of time thinking about it might not link the extreme event that they're experiencing to climate change. And so, you know, you use the example of a fire, and, you know, certainly there are wildfires very recently occurring in California. And I think that's a good example of where, you know, when you're trying to explain what caused the event, you can attribute partially the cause to climate change. So you could say something like, well, you know, due to climate change and hotter temperatures, there's going to be a longer dry season. Due to climate change, we might also expect to see more lightning strikes, so that increases the risk that there might be a wildfire. But also, you know, there's always going to be other human and natural factors that go into explaining an event like that. So, you know, land use choices and water use management and things like that are also, you know, important explanations of those wildfires. So I think helping people attribute the events they're experiencing to climate change is important, but also being sure not to exaggerate it and making sure that the various causes or explanations of a particular event are clear. And by linking it to climate change, that's when people might actually start actively changing their emissions.
Well, I thought it was really groundbreaking when the mayor of Boston, after the recent winter storm flooding, came out and said on television, well, look, this is rising seas and this is due to climate change, so get used to it. And places that have never flooded before in Boston flooded this time. That was so helpful to see that on television, to see it actually linked up. And your paper talks about our big concern with social norms and our perceptions of what others will think. Maybe we need governments and media to openly and repeatedly acknowledge that relationship with climate change in order to get us acting. What are your thoughts on that?
Certainly. And in our paper, that was definitely one of our conclusions, is that we need to very quickly connect and link these events to climate change so that people can see how climate change is directly impacting their lives. I think the example that you used with the mayor of Boston is a great one, because particularly, I think those local events are the ones where it's going to have the most resonance and the most impact with people. So talking about it and making those links is very important. There is some evidence, for example, that local weathercasters actually are very effective at talking about how, you know, the changes in local weather and extreme events that people are experiencing are connected to climate change. They're very effective at reaching their audience, and it makes a lot of sense to their audience. Again, I think because it's at that local level. The other, I would say, kind of issue that maybe needs to be taken into consideration, though, is that when you start getting beyond the local level, you know, there's such a partisan divide in the United States about climate change that when you get, you know, federal or national level politicians talking about climate change, all of a sudden it becomes about political party. All of a sudden it gets kind of divisive, and that communication just might not reach as wide an audience as the more local communication might.
This is Radio EcoShock with my guests Brian Beckage and Catherine Lacasse. So you blended the psychological model with another fairly well-known climate model. Can you tell us about that one?
Yeah, so the C-Rose model is a model that's been used for quite a while in the context of, well, in many contexts, but in the context of United Nations climate negotiations and it's used for educational purposes. And it's a fairly computationally simple model in the sense that you can run it on your desktop computer, but it's been tuned to match the output of the more complex GCM, or global change models, or global circulation models that run in supercomputers and take a very long time to run. And so it reproduces the behavior of those models, of those much more complex models, very well. And so it suited our purposes quite well for the work we're doing, because we want to explore a large range of parameter space of how people might respond and then how that would impact the climate system. And so it allowed us to do hundreds of thousands of simulations in a fairly short time, which we couldn't have done using a full GCM. But going back to what I was saying earlier about the theory of planned behavior and how we implemented it in our model in a sort of a simplistic way, that going forward, I could see as people develop models of increasing complexity of human behavioral response to risk perception, you might at some point want to consider going to more complex GCM models.
Yeah, it sounds like one problem, and this is just a minor detail, is that you're adjusting what happens with climate to what humans do, and then what humans do to what happens with climate. You get feedbacks that are feeding back into feedbacks. How do you regulate or account for that kind of open-ended problem?
Yeah, and so that's what's, I think, very interesting about our model, is how it does have those dynamic linkages, how each affects the other, and I think that makes it very interesting and novel. And so in our model, how it works is it works on an annual basis. So what happens this year impacts what happens next year. And so the feedbacks occur on these annual cycles. And so it's not always clear beforehand what the trajectory of the climate system is going to be because of these feedbacks. And so that's what makes this work, I think, particularly exciting, is that, as you say, you don't know exactly how this system is going to resolve itself because of these feedbacks. And that adds to the richness of this approach.
Brian Beckett, you've done in-depth studies of the reaction to climate change of things like trees and plants and diversity. I suppose we are just another species, are we? I mean, from studies of plant and animal responses to climate change, can we learn anything about the human response?
So, yes, we are another species, although I wouldn't say just another species, because, we have we're sentient. We have technology that can greatly increase our influence on our own planet. And so how humans respond and how humans structure our societies and our world has a very large impact, not only on our own society and our own people, on humans, but also on plants and animals. The second part of your question was, can we learn about human responses from animal responses and plant responses? And I'm sure you probably can in some ways, but I think, we are so different in our technology and our sentience that we are really driving the system to a large degree that we are special in that respect.
And what about the human response to climate-induced species loss? When our favorite birds or mammals disappear or flowers we love, are we more likely to act to reduce our emissions?
So, that's a great question, and it depends on how closely we perceive the linkage. So one of the results of our paper is the need for attribution, which is, if there is some large climate event, extreme event someplace in the world, is timely and accurate attribution of that event to climate change, if indeed climate change is driving that particular event. And so it's the attribution part. So if people associate the loss of a species or the loss of plant or animal species with climate change, that may very well impact their emissions behavior. But there are so many changes that are occurring in the world, and the world is so complex that people may not make that linkage. They may associate more with loss of habitat or some other change in the natural world, and they may ascribe that to either natural fluctuations or to human-induced fluctuations. And so that attribution becomes less clear, less straightforward. And as it becomes less clear and less straightforward, then the human response to emissions behavior can decrease the sensitivity.
Okay, and we know from science that as the world warms more, events that might have happened once in a lifetime may come three or more times. We know that there were people that were flooded out in New Orleans that were then flooded out again in Houston. How will that acceleration of extremes affect emissions behavior, or will it?
Another great question. And again, it depends. So the attribution part is very important. And so if people if humans perceive that those extreme events are associated with climate change, then they're more likely to respond. But there are other aspects of behavior that come into play. So one is, as climate changes, we get used to the differing frequency of extreme events, and that becomes the new normal. And so something we might have perceived as being extreme at one point now seems more normal, and so we might not have that same level of response to it. And then also, you know, humans tend to forget the extreme events as time progresses. And so there is this problem of what we ascribe to being extreme. So our recognition of extreme events, which changes over time, and then there's the attributional link. Even if we acknowledge something as being extreme, do we attribute it to climate change? And then there's the forgetting. So it's complex. So what kind of comes into play is the rate at which climate change is occurring, and particularly the rate at which changes in extreme events are occurring, and then, you know, how people normalize new patterns of weather, how quickly that happens, and then how quickly we forget. So it's these differing timescales of human behavior and the climate system that kind of interact to determine how motivated people are to adjust their emissions behaviors.
We talked about floods and fires and hurricanes, things like that, and the impact of climate-induced events is obviously very strong when they happen. Talk to us about what psychologists have learned about sensing these disasters.
In general, the reason why we even focused on looking at how people experience these extreme events is because a lot of research done on risk perception has found that when people experience a risk firsthand, it leads to much greater perceptions of risk than if you're just reading about it and learning about it. And maybe that's not really surprising, but when you experience a risk like that, when you experience an extreme event, it's going to evoke emotional responses so that you're not just, you know, kind of cognitively calculating like, oh, what's the likelihood that there'll be a flood in my community? You've got emotions that go along with it, and that really strengthens people's concerns. So I'd say that's why sensing is so important. On the other hand, you also have false alarms, so that's something you also want to be concerned about, right? So when people are expecting an event and they're watching the news and it's supposed to be awful, and then when it actually comes, it doesn't have too big of an impact on them, that's also something that they're sensing. And they're also going to use that information to maybe make decisions that maybe something's less risky than they thought it was before if they experience some kind of false alarm.
Are the repeated extreme events cumulative in memory? That is, how is the second one sensed compared to the first? Catherine Lacasse, can we become habituated to emergencies and so the motivation to cut emissions might drop?
You know, I would say yes, that's certainly a possibility. In our model, we wanted to take this into account. We wanted to look at, you know, as extreme events start increasing over time, does this become the new normal and people habituate to it and therefore it doesn't seem as risky anymore? We accounted for this by comparing the number of extreme events people experienced each year to the number of events in the recent past. So we made it so that people were kind of actively making this comparison. And what I would say is, you know, we don't have a lot of solid numbers right now about how quickly people habituate. And so because of that, in our model, we varied sensing to see if we created a scenario where people very quickly habituate, is that different than a scenario in which people kind of continually sense extreme events as extreme for a long time? And what we found was that in our model, it didn't actually have that much of an impact whether or not people were habituating quickly or whether they were sensitive for a longer period of time. It didn't have too much of an impact on later change in emissions.
And you and Brian also talk about forgetting. I wonder, do we really forget being evacuated due to fires or losing a home to a storm? Or does the event just fade away from our decision-making process so we go on polluting as much as we like?
I would say no, as you say, you know, people don't completely forget. And especially, you know, extreme examples like you just mentioned, being evacuated due to a fire or losing a home, those are events that people aren't going to forget. But you can think about the other things that happen when you experience an extreme event. Maybe the fear surrounding all your neighbors, or maybe being concerned about the fire coming close to your home, although you weren't actually evacuated. And so there's a lot of things that go along with experiencing an extreme event. and that kind of thing, maybe those slightly less extreme experiences do just start to fade out of the decision-making process. Basically, what I would say is that over time, you know, you continually are having experiences. So if you experience an extreme event, 1 year, 2 years later, it might still be very important. But 10 years later, you've had 10 more years of other experiences, and all of that information is going to go into your decision-making process. So it's not that you forgot about it, but it's just that there's been more recent information that you're using instead.
We'll be right back with more from Brian Bekich and Catherine Lacasse on the crossovers between human psychology and greenhouse gas emissions.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org. This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex. My two guests, Brian Bekich and Catherine Lacasse, are explaining their new study into the ways human psychology feeds back, for better or for worse, into our new climate future. And talking about changing our emissions behavior, you find two types of change, non-cumulative and cumulative responses. Brian, please explain those, maybe with an example or two.
Yeah, so in our model, we did look at two modes of emission behavioral change, and that was non-cumulative and cumulative. The non-cumulative were short-term responses. So if you experienced extreme event in a given year and you associate that with climate change and the other social factors were such that you were concerned enough and motivated enough to do something about it, then you would have some kind of short-term response. And these short-term responses, though, would not necessarily carry out into the subsequent years. So it might be something like you might be more conscientious about moderating your home temperature, adjusting your thermostat to save energy in the winter or summer months, or you might be more careful about how many miles you drove in your car to limit your emission from driving. But those behaviors are easily reversed, and so depending on the number of extreme events in the subsequent year, you may no longer be particularly motivated to continue those behaviors, and you can stop them. And so those were the non-cumulative emission changes, and we found that they had relatively little impact on the final global temperature in our model ones. Now, in contrast, the cumulative responses were more long-term, and so in this case, you would perceive some extreme event, and you would attribute it to climate change. But rather than doing a short-term response, you would do something that's a longer-term response, like invest in insulation in your house or maybe a hybrid vehicle. And so those kinds of investments would not only reduce your emissions in the current year, but they would play out over time, and so your emission savings would accumulate. And no matter what the climate system did the following year, you would still have that insulation in your house or that hybrid vehicle, and so your emissions would accumulate. And we found that kind of behavior, that's more the infrastructural changes, the long-term changes, had by far the largest impacts on global temperature.
And yet here's one of the strange things that comes out of your paper. Even when there's a high social acceptance of the need for emissions reduction changes, if the people don't think those are possible, if they don't see how anything's going to work, then real emissions in the world still lead us to a place that's 4.9 degrees C hotter. Can you talk about how that works?
Yeah, again, so I think this is a question that probably Katie could address in more detail. But in our model, what we found was that there are a variety of social factors that enter into the theory of planned behavior and that we incorporate it into our model of human response. But two of those were perceived social norms, so it's like what your neighbors and what your people in your social circle perceive as being an acceptable and normal behavior with respect to emissions. Another one of them was perceived behavioral control. So that's how if you felt like you could engage in behaviors that actually would make a difference. And it was the interaction of both of those that was really critical to having a large impact. So that you not only needed the desire to want to lower your emissions, but you needed to have the sense that you had some control, you had some behavioral control, and something you would do could actually have an impact. And it was the interaction of those two that was critical in affecting meaningful reductions in emissions and future global temperature.
This is one of the important things I think about your paper, is that you bring out this factor of the uncertainty of social feedback as a real factor in what climate change will do and what we will experience. So What I'm wondering is, when it comes to projected warming, how does the uncertainty from our social reaction that you studied compare to the uncertainty that scientists find in other possible responses of physical systems, things like changes in the ocean currents or thawing permafrost?
Yeah, the physical uncertainty in the climate models is of the magnitude of about 3.5 degrees Celsius. And so what that means is there's enough uncertainty in how the system, how the Earth's system, how the climate system is going to respond to a doubling in CO2 from pre-industrial levels. And there's a lot of work trying to refine that uncertainty to reduce it so that we can be more sure of how the Earth system, the climate system, will respond to a given level of emissions. Now, in our model, we looked at the magnitude of the uncertainty, the behavioral uncertainty in our model, meaning that there is a broad suite or range of different values that we could assign to the social parameters, and not much, it's not clear where the true values should be. Should be, in the sense, are currently reflect people's behaviors. And what we found was that behavioral uncertainty was 2.8 degrees Celsius, which is very close to the 3.5 degrees Celsius uncertainty in the physical system. And I think that's important because it indicates that not only do we need to continue to focus on the physical uncertainty and trying to resolve that uncertainty, but we need to also focus on behavioral responses and begin to better understand how humans perceive the risk and what motivates us to either reduce our emissions behavior or switch to alternative energy technologies or not. And I think that's another important result of this paper is emphasizing that need to focus on this behavioral uncertainty in addition to the physical uncertainty.
Catherine, please tell us about the contribution of the young scientist from Utah, Peter D. Howe. For example, I was intrigued with his paper, Who Remembers a Hot Summer or a Cold Winter?
Yes, so Peter certainly was, you know, our expert on how people perceive and respond to local weather events and climate shifts. And he's done quite a bit of research on that, looking at how accurate people perceive the weather or the precipitation in their areas. And in that paper you referred to, he specifically focused on how prior beliefs have an impact on how people experience those warm summers. So what he found was that people who initially did not believe climate change was occurring were less likely to report that the previous summer was, quote-unquote, warmer than usual than those who believed that climate change was happening. And so I think this really highlights, you know, how important people's initial beliefs are in the way they experience things and in trying to understand how different people might experience the same event in a different way. On the one hand, people who are very concerned about climate change or might be very quick to take those few very hot days in the summer and say, aha, yes, the summer was warmer than usual, whereas people who don't believe that climate change is occurring are less likely to use those warm days as evidence that the summer was warmer than usual.
Boy, that's a circular problem. I mean, if people don't believe in climate change and then they experience it and they're less likely to believe in it anyway.
Yes, I have to say, there's not an easy solution right in the middle of that. But I'd say effective communication that resonates with people locally is probably the best thing we have to aim at.
And I feel a need to return to really one of my first questions. Right now, it's still normal to fly a whole family to the Pacific for a wedding. It's still normal to drive across great distances burning gas because we feel like it. What does it take to get from that to social condemnation of emissions? Because it's bringing us more extreme conditions. It's hurting our economy. It's killing people. How do we reach that tipping point of emissions behavior change?
One of the most important findings from our study is that one-time behaviors, that once you've taken that action, it continually reduces emissions from that point forward, seem to be more important than the behaviors that need to be continually enacted over and over again, like a habit. So because of this, what we concluded was that policy and infrastructural changes seem to matter more in our model than the kind of individual decisions that people make day to day. So if you're looking at a flight, for example, choosing to avoid a particular flight because you're feeling very concerned about climate change, people might make that decision once, but the next time an event comes up, they might reverse that decision and say, you know what, I'm going to take this flight. It's not a consistent reduction in emissions. However, altering people's transportation options, making it easier or cheaper for people to maybe take trains or use other types of transportation that aren't going to have as large of an impact as an airplane, that is a change that once it's made is going to keep continually having an impact on every other person who's making that transportation decision. Or increasing technology that makes planes less harmful, that's reducing their emissions. Something like that is going to continually reduce the emissions of every single person who takes that plane. So that's what we concluded, was that these policy and infrastructure changes seem to matter the most. And so the good news is the focus can be pushed more towards those types of changes rather than the kinds of individual level changes that we have to make every day.
Brian Beckage, can your models accommodate fringe responses like interventions, outright panic, government impotence, economic collapse, or maybe even a war to assert authority during climate chaos or food shortages? Are those sorts of things included in your model?
Well, so as I was saying earlier, our model was sort of an initial attempt at incorporating the behavioral responses of humans into a climate model. And so it functions sort of in abstractions. So we have parameters that represent perceived social norms and perceived behavior control, et cetera. And you could create scenarios that respond to some of those situations that you just described, and you could go ahead and see where in parameter space they might lie in terms of our behavioral model, and then make a projection. But I think what you're really asking is for a more realistic portrayal of those events in the climate system. And I think for that really to happen, you need to take this model to and add complexity to it. For instance, begin to incorporate different responses from different regions of the world. So all humans are not the same, obviously. We have different sets of beliefs and different social norms and different perceptions of behavioral control, et cetera. And so you would want to begin to account for that heterogeneity in humans and human behavior. And at the same time, the climate response to greenhouse gases in the atmosphere is also not homogeneous across the globe, and so it's very heterogeneous. And so how the different impacts of climate change play out spatially and how that overlaps with different human groups and their sets of behaviors, that interaction, that spatial interaction, adds a whole another level of complexity to how the system will respond. And so that is something I think one direction you would want to expand this model out to look at spatial responses. And that's something that we are beginning to work on now.
That's what I was going to ask you. What do you hope this paper will achieve?
The first thing I want this paper to achieve was to see, or step back even further, not the paper, but when we undertook this project, was to see how important linking, in a dynamic sense, human behavior and risk perception to a climate model was, how important that linkage was or could be. And the answer is it can be very important, and it adds another level of, I think, realism to these climate models and to the ongoing discussion about human-induced climate change, and that it brings in this whole other component of human behavior and risk perception into this discussion. And so I think that's really important. And so that was, I think, an important result. It's just bringing this to the discussion.
Brian Beckage, thank you so much for talking with us on Radio EcoShock.
You're very welcome. Thank you for having me.
The theory of planned behavior employed in your paper is also being used by advertising agencies to get into our brains, to adjust our perceptions, and they hope tip us into motivation to buy their products. Can we use the same theory to help save the climate? And if so, who would implement it? I mean, would it be government manipulation of people's minds to use psychology to help stop horrible climate change?
To answer the first part of the question, I would say yes. The theory of planned behavior can be applied to any kind of behavior, whether you're trying to sell a product or you're trying to get people to do something that's healthier for them or healthier for the planet. So understanding what influences people's behavior can be used by anyone. And in terms of who would implement it, what I would say is that there certainly are groups that are implementing it now, specifically to try to change behaviors to reduce emissions. So one example that I really like is, I don't know if you've ever seen this, I know I get it on my utility bills, but a fair amount of electricity utility companies are including within their monthly electricity bill a graph that actively compares how much electricity you're using to how much electricity your neighbors are using. And the goal here is to really set a social norm. It's something that you don't have a lot of knowledge about. You don't go around comparing electricity bills with your neighbors. And so that's an active way for you to look at how much you're using, see if you're using more than your neighbors, and make a decision that maybe I'm going to reduce my behavior so that I can be more similar to my neighbors. That particular example is really using social norms from the theory of planned behavior to try to have an impact on people's behavior and to try to help them reduce their emissions. So as I said, there's utility companies doing it. There's certainly nonprofit organizations that are sometimes partnered up with government organizations that use the different aspects of the theory of planned behavior to promote their environmental behavior campaigns, whether they're trying to get people to stop idling their cars or whether they're trying to promote more solar panel usage in their community. And so I'd say, I don't know if I'd call it government manipulation of people's minds, but it's more once you understand what leads to behavior, anyone can use that information to try to design programs that make it easy and that make it socially acceptable for people to perform the behavior that you're looking for.
Catherine, what are your hopes for the next steps in developing the psychology of climate change?
One thing I would say is that there is a larger and larger group of environmental psychologists that are concerned with climate change, and we want to keep focusing on new issues as they emerge. So one topic that is getting more attention right now is how people are not just experiencing climate change, but how they're adapting to it and how it's impacting not just their behaviors, but also their mental health. So I think learning more about how people in the U.S. are experiencing those climate change impacts now is really important. A second thing I think is very important is focusing on what the best communication techniques are to talk about climate change and share information about climate change in our current political climate. As I mentioned, you know, climate change can be divisive, and there's more and more research being done on how to best talk about it that resonates with different audiences. And the last thing I would say is I think more and more psychologists can get involved in interdisciplinary collaborations. This project that led to us designing this model included lots of different specialists. So there were climate modelers, there were biological scientists, mathematicians, and other social scientists like geographers and psychologists like myself. And we each brought our own expertise, and that allowed us to complete this project that none of us could have done individually. So if psychologists really want, or other researchers really want to work on projects that are going to have a big impact on climate change, pooling the knowledge from different specialists and working on projects together, I think, is really important.
And Catherine Lacasse, thank you so much for talking with us on Radio EcoShock today.
Well, thank you very much.
You're listening to Radio EcoShock with your host, Alex Smith.
You've just heard Dr. Brian Beckage from the University of Vermont and Dr. Catherine Lacasse from the Department of Psychology at Rhode Island College. We've been discussing their new paper, Linking Models of Human Behavior and Climate Alters Projected Climate Change. It was just published in the journal Nature Climate Change. For links to follow up, please visit my weekly show blog, published every Wednesday at ecoshock.org.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
Another new study on human responses to climate change has just come out. Stay tuned for Sabrina Helm. Why are you concerned about climate change? That may determine whether you or even our whole society will do anything about it. That's in a new study published January 2018 in the journal Global Environmental Change. From the University of Arizona, we've reached the lead author, Dr. Sabrina Helms. She is Associate Professor of Family and Consumer Science at the U of A's College of Agriculture and Life Sciences. Sabrina, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you very much for having me. It's a pleasure to be on the show.
We only have a few minutes, so Sabrina, please dive right in to describe those three types of climate profiles you discovered in your survey?
What we have been looking in is how three different motivations may encourage people to do more about pro-environmental behaviors and maybe counter climate change. So we were looking at what we call three types of environmental concern. There are people who are concerned about the environment because of the possible effects it might have on themselves, like their own health, maybe also their financial means, their home, etc. We call those the egoistically motivated consumers. Then there's other people who have a more altruistic view, a social altruistic view. They are concerned about climate change because it's threatening to humanity and other people. And then there's a third group of people who are concerned because of the negative effects that climate change is likely to have on nature in general, plants and animal life. And what we find is that actually the last mentioned group are the ones who are most likely to perceive depression regarding the possible threats of climate change and really feel, well, bad about what's going on right now, and are also, on the other hand, motivated to act accordingly and to change their behavior and embark in what we call pro-environmental behaviors, such as saving energy, saving water, traveling less, etc. Whereas those who are egoistically motivated don't really perceive much stress due to climate change. It seems like they don't really recognize any effects that climate change currently has on their lives. And similarly to those who are altruistically motivated, they perceive some stress, but they don't really associate any forms of depression or pro-environmental behaviors with that.
You're almost better off not to realize that the whole biosphere is threatened if you want to just avoid ecological stress.
Ignorance is bliss. looking at the data, it's a bit like that. Yeah, the more you tend to worry about animal life and plant life, maybe broadly speaking, the oceans, etc., the more likely you are to already see change and perceive change, because that's what's being reported in the media a lot, those kind of changes, right? And biodiversity loss, etc. So we already see how negative impacts happen there due to climate change. And so if you're concerned about that, you are likely to also have negative effects on your own mental health. Whereas if you're not worried about these kind of things, you don't see much reported yet about how climate change is going to affect you personally, your own health, maybe your own living conditions, particularly here in the United States. Unless you live in an area that's prone to be hit by hurricanes, you don't have much to lose. Yeah? This is possibly going to change, but that may be the explanation why people who have more concern about animals and plants and nature in general is why they are already more affected and maybe also more likely to do anything about it and change their behavior.
In your study, what do you mean by ecological coping?
Ecological coping is psychological adaptation to the threats of climate change. It's a purely psychological context that we are looking at in this particular study. So it can have different forms. It's a whole range of ways which we can use in order to psychologically cope with the threats of climate change. They range from denial of your own impact on climate change, to wishful thinking, like, oh, I wish this wouldn't happen, but there's really nothing I can do about it, to really taking a more active approach, including being angry, emotionally involved. I'm very unhappy about what's happening there. I'm getting angry if I think about what people do to climate. Those are responses which are not necessarily very productive or healthy for the individual because they don't really lead to changes that can help them out of the state. And then there are other approaches where people envision that they can actually do something about their situation and start taking a more active approach, such as looking for more information, considering ways in which they can have an impact on the environment and climate and changing behavior, and really getting into a coping mechanism that gets them also to actually embark in these pro-environmental behaviors.
Sabrina, to drive support and action, environment groups often focus on the beauty of nature, or maybe they pick an iconic creature that we all love as an argument. But it sounds from your study that that approach would actually be missing some of the people who do know about climate change.
Yeah, that's what we take from our findings. It's basically that a lot of the messaging that is out there is a bit about like preaching to the choir. People who are already really engaged in climate change action and are really worried about the biosphere and animal life, oceans, etc., they probably don't need messaging that shows them or continues to show them these kind of effects. They're already there. They're already doing something. Whereas this kind of imagery, like the iconic animals, etc., don't really speak to those who are these egoistically concerned or altruistically concerned people out there. Yeah, who, if they were addressed in a different manner that is more aligned with their own interests and their own motivations, would maybe have a better chance to also change their behavior or get motivated to actually do something. So that's why we suggest we should really reconsider how we go about messaging in order to also reach these other groups.
I think many of our listeners already feel stress and worry about the climate future, but you've suggested when it comes to climate change, there is, quote, the potential for large-scale negative mental health effects in our society. Is it possible that a climate depression or despair might actually derail real climate action?
That's an interesting question. Yes and no. Yes, in the sense that if one of the coping mechanisms very often is denial, right? Denial of own responsibility, or even denial that anything is happening that could negatively affect people and the planet. And that obviously is something that does not lead to action. And if we assume that only through changes in behavior, people have a good way to cope with climate change, avoid the negative mental health effects, and then actually also adapt to climate change and maybe even mitigate the climate change, then denial is obviously a dysfunctional form of coping with this. No, in the sense that I don't think that we are going to be looking at a mass mental health problem in the immediate term now. Yeah, I think that the way we need to start thinking about the negative effects climate change has on mental health in general is that we can learn from other areas where mental health effects have already been shown. I compare our research a little bit with what has been conducted in the context of effects of terrorism or also major weather events such as hurricanes, etc. Those are one-time events which have vast effects on people and can very negatively affect their mental health, but we already know how we can help people cope with that. Psychology has already developed a repertoire of helping people to get into a better place again. And we can learn from that. Climate change is different because it's a continuous and very severe change that is sort of like creeping and slowly changing all of our lives. But if we start considering how this can also have mental health effects, we already have, I think, the instruments available to get to a better place.
We're going to have to leave it there. We've been talking with Dr. Sabrina Helm from the University of Arizona. She is the lead author of the study titled Differentiating Environmental Concern in the Context of Psychological Adaptation to Climate Change. And that was just published in Global Environmental Change. You can find links to follow up in my show blog at ecoshock.org. Sabrina, it's been a pleasure talking with you. Thank you.
Thank you so much for your interest in our work.
Growing up with an ecologically dysfunctional human family can be tough. The more we know about our real damage and the threatened future, the more it can hurt us all, mentally and spiritually. I'm sure you know what I'm talking about. Fortunately, there are experts, artists, and guides, and just plain people working on strategies to help us cope and maybe help our society survive this civilization. That's it for this week. I'm Alex Smith. Please join me again next time for more Radio EcoShock.